It's a real pleasure to be here with you this morning and to talk about play. And it only seems fitting, let's start by playing a game. Does everybody know how to play rock, paper, scissors?
Yeah.
Okay, rock, paper, scissors. Turn to each other, groups of three are fine. Get ready, I'm gonna count three, I know it's complicated. One, two, three. Okay, how many people here chose rock? Okay, how many people here chose scissor? How many chose paper? How many chose lizard or Spock? That's for you Big Bang fans out there, I know you're there. Okay, how did you feel about that? Did you care one bit whether you won or not? Not really, no. It wasn't important, was it? What was the important thing? Playing the game, exactly right. That is what we would have called, academically speaking, loosely structured play. We'll get into really structured play in a moment, but you're enjoying yourselves, so let's take a little while to get there. Let's look at the idea of play. Now, what do we mean by play? It is my contention that play is at the core of the human experience. It is at the very heart of how we communicate and how we create. It may, in fact, also be the origins of our very earliest forms of worship and the explorations of the mysteries of life and death. I would go so far as to say that despite our often very earnest and industrious collective and individual pursuit responsibly for truth and enlightenment as Unitarians, and the determination to make sure that all the work that goes into getting one of these services off the ground and running and the church doing dag nabbit and everybody better be on a committee, that nevertheless, play and playfulness is a Unitarian quality. That's a big claim for a game of rock, paper, and scissors. And Nancy is very kindly agreed to move the, since I'm not as high tech enough to learn how to use a remote, I can barely use my television these days. I'm going to be giving her hand signals. It might be rock, it might be paper. You have to be flexible over there. Now, it is sad to say that in Western society especially, play is greatly devalued. Now, I'm not talking about serious play. I mean, if you can play baseball or you can play hockey or golf, that we take that really seriously. In fact, we can have riots about it. That's how serious we take that. I am talking about goofing around. I'm talking about having fun. I'm talking about when you're doing your laundry and it turns into a spontaneous basketball game to get socks into the old laundry basket. Or my favorite, you're in conversation and somebody cracks the first pun on a topic, and you keep on going till you run out of puns. Never. I know. Rare occurrence. But currently, we devalue that in our society, even though research and academic studies show that it may have been, in fact, the cement that held our earliest ancestors as hunter-gatherers together. But we just don't take it seriously, and rock this time. That's good, thank you. Look at this definition of the word play. Good heavens. Something that isn't serious or practical. My goodness me, that doesn't sound worth doing, does it? Adults are spending more and more time at work. I mean, who has time to play when you got bills to pay, right? And children have less and less free time to play as well. Increasingly, their play is structured, especially when it comes to sports and athletic. How about dynamite this time? Great. Now, when it comes to our academics, especially the public school system, play for children is confined, supervised, controlled, and in fact, in some instances, it's even frowned upon. This can lead to depression and anxiety in children. It can also lead to open acts of rebellion, especially amongst boys, for which the system is not terribly well designed, in my opinion. Paper. Oh, yeah, I think educators and employers and just about all of us could do well to look at the last half of that definition of play, because this is the origins, the roots of the word play. And for me, you know, I love this explanation. I also like the last part of it, to be able to leap or dance for joy. Now, to me, that does not sound like something that's impractical and has no use or utility in our lives. I think also that people could do well, if you want to learn a little bit about play, we can benefit from the works of this man. This is Professor Peter Gray. He's a Boston College behavioral psychologist. He's also the author of a great book called Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. Now, Gray argues that the importance of play is crucial for healthy psychological development and the ability to thrive in life, and that it is woefully underestimated by parents and educators. He writes, playing with other children away from adults is how children learn to make their own decisions, control their emotions and impulses, see from others' perspectives, negotiate differences with others, and make friends. In short, play is how children learn to take control of their lives. So how does Professor Gray define play? It's kind of a big thing and hard to sort of nail down, but he has got these five characteristics. And you can see by these five characteristics how important the sort of freedom of play, of unstructured play, is. It's self-chosen. Nobody's going to force you to play rock, paper, scissors. You just say, hey, we're going to play rock, paper, scissors. It's also an activity where the means are more important than the ends. It doesn't matter who wins. You just play the game. It does have structure, but that structure comes from us. It comes from our imagination, so it's a projection of ourselves. And also, he said, flipping the paper over, play is imaginative. It's non-literal. It's mentally removed from real or serious life. It takes us away from those common concerns, you know, paying the bills, meeting the mortgage, appointments to make, that sort of thing. And it involves a state of mind that's alert but non-stressed. And I think we could all do with a little less stress in our lives. So Gray cites many reasons for the decline of free play in our society. Families don't know their neighbors quite often, less and less. Parents fear the danger of unsupervised play of their children in society. Increased time at school for those children, at homework, in adult-directed activities outside school, and most significantly that there is this societal attitude that childhood is a time for resume building, and that free play is wasted time. Well, Free to Learn outlines the difference between structured play, like, say, Little League, and free play, which is like a pickup game of baseball. There's a profound difference. And he emphasizes the need for the latter in a society worldwide, not just amongst children, but adults too. And we don't really need Professor Gray's book to teach us the difference. We're gonna play rock, paper, and scissors again. But this time, I would like the people at the end of each row here, from Sue to John, all the way down that row, stand up as you are able, or look stern and look down your row. And Ev, if everybody on that end can do the same, Deborah, look down your row. And I want you as individuals to turn to each other and be in pairs of two, please. And if you're not in a pair of two, you can't play. Because, da-da-da-da, you see, now, we are so in the spirit. Nancy, the rules. These are the rules. This is structured play. You will adhere to them, please. Remember, I want you to try to win this game. I want you to remember that a rock breaks a pair of scissors. That paper covers the rock. And that scissors cut the paper. All right, supervisors, make sure they're playing right. Look stern. On the count of three, try to win. Remember, 1, 2, 3. Okay. Okay. How many people here actually tried to win? Okay. There's some in every crowd. How many people here found themselves just a little bit resenting that whole exercise? Absolutely. Was it as fun as the first time? No, I think we can all agree on that. Although you are free to disagree. Yeah, you were a lot noisier, weren't you, right? Isn't that interesting? I think that's a very good point. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. You might have felt a little bit like, oh, for heaven's sakes, because the instinct for free play is ingrained in all of us from a very early age, and it stays with us as adults. And that's because Gray's research suggests that early hunter-gatherers used playtime and humor and inclusive joking around to overcome those innate tendencies in groups towards aggression and dominance. Play is necessary to make cooperative societies function. He writes, play and humor are not just a means of adding fun to their lives. They were means of maintaining the band's existence, means of promoting actively the egalitarian attitude, the intense sharing, and relative peacefulness for which hunter-gatherers are justly famous and upon which they depended for their survival. Gray says that the most important social skill we have in life is how to please other people while at the same time fulfilling our own needs and desires. And in self-organized play, free play, he contends, children learn to get along with diverse others, to compromise and to anticipate the needs and meet those needs of others. One more quote. To play well and to keep others interested in continuing to play with you, you must be able to see the world from the other player's point of view. Children and teenagers in hunter-gatherer cultures played in this way more or less constantly. They developed into extraordinarily cooperative, egalitarian adults. My observations indicate that aged mixed free play in our culture, in those places where it still can be found, has all of these qualities. So it's an enduring thing. Now, I know that's Diane Ackerman's quote, and that's Einstein. I'm just playing with you. Social play counteracts tendencies towards greed and arrogance. It promotes concern for the feelings and well-beings of others. It's also the social glue that held those small bands of hunter-gatherers together, often under very extreme conditions. Gray contends that they used humor deliberately to maintain equality and to stop quarrels, and their means of sharing had game-like qualities. They maintained playful attitudes in their hunting and gathering and other subsistence activities, partly by allowing each person to choose when and how much they would engage in such activities. Now, to me, this view of play is a really intrinsically Unitarian one because I can see Unitarian values reflected in his lens. I can see, for instance, respecting the worth and dignity of every individual within that view. I can also see justice and equity and compassion in human relations reflected in it, respect for the interconnected web of life. I even see a democratic process of a sort, and a sense of establishing a peaceful community with liberty and justice for all while still having a bit of fun. Now, we don't really have to go all the way back to the Neolithic age to find examples of how play is an essential human survival tool. Sir Ernest Shackleton was an Irish English explorer. He was instrumental in opening up the Antarctic. And he was a very interesting and admirable fellow. I really admire his leadership skills because he led small teams into the world's most hostile environment where the margin between survival and disaster was razor thin. But he still never missed up an opportunity to have fun. This is especially true on his ill-fated transpolar expedition 1914 to 17, where he attempted to cross the Antarctic and never even made it onto the continent because his ship, which you can see in this picture, got stuck in the ice of the Weddell Sea far off the coast. Now, he and his men had to endure a very long, very cold Antarctic winter out on the ice trapped in the ship. How do you keep the men's spirit up? You play. Along with the day-to-day routine of keeping the ship from being crushed in the ice, Shackleton made sure that he had staged pantomimes, plays, and games to keep the men's spirit up. Now, in the spring, rather than needlessly exhaust his men, after they'd done all the essential work of transferring all the equipment and supplies out of the ship and onto the ice, he would say, "All right, boys," and you can see it here, "time for a bit of soccer." So they'd play soccer on the pack ice, right? When that ship finally got crushed in the ice, the men had no option but to go in open boats 600 kilometers to a tiny speck of rock in the Weddell Sea called Elephant Island, completely uninhabited except for elephant seals, a few penguins, and a whole bunch of schoolgirls. But even in this extraordinary circumstance, the spirit of fun and playfulness that Shackleton, who was known as the boss to his men, infused in that party kept on. So when Shackleton set off on an over 700 nautical mile trip to find a whaling station in the middle of the ocean to try and get some help, he left his second in command, Frank Wild, to run things. And he had the men build a hut on Elephant Island of the remaining bits of the lifeboats that had landed them on that island. Now, they could have sat there in the dark with their little blubber lamps spitting away and sort of glumly thought, "Oh, God, we're never going to be rescued." But they didn't. They amused themselves. And one of the things they did to amuse themselves was to compose this little song. It was a pan to Captain Wild and his attempts to keep their spirits up and moving and to provide shelter. And, you know, they sang it endlessly. And I think at the end it was just perhaps partly to torment him a little bit, but it showed the spirit of playfulness. For the people who can't, "My name is Frankie Wild, oh, me hut's on Elephant Isle, the walls without a single brick, the roof's without a tile, but nevertheless I must confess by many and many a mile, it is the most palatial dwelling place you'll find on Elephant Isle." There is an actual recording. It was recorded. Yes. So, next slide. Oh, yes, here we are. That's Ernest Shackleton, and that's one of his mottos. And Shackleton returned, and he rescued his men. And it is, I think, a tribute to his leadership style and approach that not a single man died on that expedition, despite being exposed to the harshest environment and in the most dreadful conditions for over 2 years. And think about this. I can see Professor Gray's theories and principles of play at work in this episode as well, too. If the boss is so unworried that he's going to let us play soccer, we might not be that bad off. We might actually be able to get through this. I think that Shackleton's approach of using play led to a spirit of hope and optimism that ultimately was crucial to their survival. We also see Gray's principle of it is a break from real or serious life at work here, because it was a chance for them to forget about the fact that they were trapped at the bottom of the world with absolutely no outside help unless they went out and got it for a little while. Recharge your mental batteries. Be able to go out and face your situation again and carry on. And they all got back to England. Now, that is all a bit serious, don't you think? So I think we need some free playtime. Time for rock, paper, scissors again. Or in this case, as you can see, I've incorporated Lizard Spock into it. Or you can do just something as simple as odds and evens. And you can turn to each other in groups of two or three or more, okay? And I'm going to give you a minute just to play. So on the count of three, because we do need some light structure here, and for the sake of brevity in the clock, a little bit of time. One, two, three, play. Ding, 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 ding. The bell just ending, new hour ended, sorry. Yeah, I know. It's horrible. There weren't any. It was up to you to impose some sort of rule. Okay, how was that different? A little bit different than that structured play, I'm willing to bet. A little bit more fun. Okay. Now, I mentioned off the top how play is also a way of communicating and creating. And you might say, well, that's very well for children, but what about adults? Well, I've always found that taking a playful approach to a challenge actually makes that task, no matter how loathsome it might be, a little bit more endurable. In some cases, it makes it enjoyable. Now, Joan very kindly mentioned that I write this series of mystery novels called Mr. Jenna. And Mr. Jenna is, in fact, based on a real-life person, my former colleague at the Province newspaper, the crime reporter, Salim Jiwa. And one of the ways that people who are day-to-day have to deal with gruesome murders and unpleasant characters and the worst side of human life actually cope with that. How do they get the mental armor to carry on day after day doing that? Well, you make fun of it. You have fun. You play with the idea. And one of the things, for instance, in Pizza 911, you see a picture from the CBC production there, is that Jenna is faced in this particular case of trying to solve a murder of the victim has been dismembered and partly cremated in a pizza oven. See, you're entering the spirit right now. I never knew there were so many junior detectives. Well, so in Pizza 911, Jenna is asked, well, what's the identity? Who was in the oven? And without hesitation, he quips, a large Hawaiian. And he does so deadpan. Or is that deep dish? So, I've also found that playfulness works really well in the communications business. Right now, I'm working with the Cooperative Housing Federation of BC. And my job is to try to get a rent supplement program for low-income people. And Renee knows all about this, yes, because we've been out to her co-op. And what it is the federal subsidies are expiring, and low-income people, the support that kept their homes affordable expiring. Now, 4,000 people, or actually households, it may be as many as 10,000 people in BC, have their houses at risk. And the previous federal government didn't want to do anything about it, and the provincial government was kind of passing the buck, saying, isn't it their job? So it's a very serious issue, because nobody wants to see seniors and people with disabilities and single parents homeless and on the street. For a campaign like this to succeed, you need to harness the energies of your members, the co-ops, and you also need to be able to get the attention of government. How do you do that? Well, I've always found that you think outside the box and you present them with an image and a metaphor that says, it's like this, folks. And so, you know, you, sometimes as a consultant, you got to humiliate yourself a little bit. And so in the line of duty, I have been, as you can see, an ice cream vendor hawking resolutions and things for people to sign up and send in the government to tell them we need a solution. That's kind of an attempt at a Johnny Cash Man in Black over on the left there. Holding the big key that we have, and we call it the You Hold the Key campaign, and we remind politicians and others that they hold the key to unlocking a solution to this crisis. And one of the funnest things I did was during the last federal election where I did this sheriff thing. We did a bunch of meetings and a video and stuff, and it was to encourage co-op members to form posses to get down there to that voting station and vote for those critters who were in favor of co-op housing and our solution for a federally funded, provincially delivered rent supplement program. And I think we all know what happened in the last election, don't we? Yeah. All 18 Liberal MPs elected in that election have at least one co-op in their riding. So they know which side their bread is buttered on, because co-op people go out and vote. They're much like Unitarians. So that was a lot of fun. And I am delighted to say that it is actually working, that the federal government, the new government, has this issue at the top of their priorities, and that the provincial government, it seems to be listening. Next slide, please. Now, clearly, play can help us communicate serious and complex issues. And this is true not just in our day-to-day lives as we interact with communities and societies at large, but in our deeper pursuits, the pursuits of the mysteries of life, of that free and responsible truth, search for truth and meaning that we as Unitarians are embarked upon. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, the evidence suggests that our earliest religious rituals started out as a form of play. Professor Gray and others note that hunter-gatherers' religious beliefs and ceremonies were very playful. They were founded on the belief that the gods themselves were very playful and capricious. And so we developed all the way from Athens to the Indus, from the British Isles to British Columbia, mimetic stories, rites, and rituals that mimicked that behavior, that told those stories. And it was a way into something that was very serious, the exploration of the very meaning of life and death itself. You might say that we play at being God. You're doing it right now. So I want you to try rock, paper, and scissors one more time, but I want you to do it a little differently. Okay, I want you to think very simply about a rock, about a piece of paper, or a pair of scissors, or even dynamite if you like. I want you to personalize that image. Think in your own self, can that image actually be representative of something within my own personal mythos? Can the rock be the rock of my existence? Can the paper be our intellect, which is very fragile, and yet it can contain the most profound notions of existence? The scissors, can it be the cutting edge of reason? Or perhaps creativity that allows us to cut the entire world apart and rearrange it and create something new? So think about that for just a moment. And what I want you to do in a moment is to, I'm going to count three again, and I want you all to take the symbol you've decided upon that best represents something that speaks to you in this moment and raise it as you're able above your heads. On the count of three, folks, on the count of three. This is lightly structured play now. So that everybody can see. Okay? One, two, three. Right on. Thank you. As you can see, when it really counts, when we're playing with the stakes of life and death and the meaning of the universe, there are no winners, there are no losers. Let me sum up with the quote from Johan Huizinga, whose picture you just saw there. Johan Huizinga was a Dutch philosopher and writer and historian. He wrote extensively about play in the 20s and 30s, and his book Homo Ludens, or Playing Man, laid the foundations for research on play that Professor Gray and others would build upon. And he would tragically die in a Nazi prison in Holland just weeks before World War II ended. And it was his misfortune to be a champion of play in an era where his country was occupied by the Nazis, who were pretty much the antithesis of having fun. But he never stopped, and that's one of the reasons why he was incarcerated. And let's close with his words. Ritual grew up in sacred play. Poetry was born in play and nourished on play. Music and dancing were pure play. We have to conclude, therefore, that civilization in its earliest phases played. It does not come from play. It arises in and as play and never leaves it. Thank you all for allowing me to share this with you today.